The National Institute of Mental Health estimates that more than 13% of U.S. adults have received treatment for some kind of mental health problem. Still, the most severe cases remain the hardest to treat and take the biggest toll not just on the family and friends of those afflicted, but also on the country at large. The National Institute of Mental Health puts the economic cost of untreated mental illness in the U.S. at more than $100 billion per year. Christine Montrose is assistant professor of psychiatry at Brown University, is a practicing psychiatrist who focuses on the most severe cases. Her patients ingest knives, nails, and light bulbs and suffer from seizures and hallucinations and experience psychosis. She's the author of the new book, Falling into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. And it's a pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me on.
I am delighted that you are here as well to talk about this very important issue. When we talk about the economic cost, and you listen to that figure from the National Institute of Mental Health of an economic cost of untreated mental illness at $100 billion a year, what does that mean? I mean, how do we parse that? How do we make sense of that and not villainize the patient?
Right. I think one of the key things to remember is all of our illnesses cost us extraordinary amounts of money. So diabetes costs an enormous amount of money. Hypertension costs an enormous amount of money. We're human beings with frail bodies, and the medical treatment of those bodies incurs cost. And that's certainly the same for mental illness, just as it is for medical illness. I think also, you know, there are sometimes medical illnesses that occur that are within our own control. I think sometimes people think, oh, mental illness, it's all in your head. We certainly know now that that's not at all true, that the causes of mental illness have nothing to do with volition or willpower or an ability to sort of pull oneself up by one's bootstraps. But in contrast, we pay for all kinds of medical illnesses, you know, smoking-related, obesity-related, where there is a behavioral component. So I think the tendency to marginalize or judge the cost of mental illness and throw that marginalization toward the patients is just very, very misguided.
As I mentioned, the name of the book is Falling into the Fire. What is it like as a psychiatrist and as a physician to have I'm going to use the word luxury, but in your case, to take these patients and to consider them and their stories at length, as compared to a typical clinical situation?
That's right. One of the reasons that I really chose to write Falling into the Fire was that increasingly as clinicians, we have less and less time to spend with our patients. But these were the cases that really gnawed at me and kept me up at night that I really could not make sense of and could not determine whether or not the course of action my colleagues and I had elected to take was in fact the right way to treat these patients. So writing for me gives me an opportunity to really dive deeply into these cases, to research not only what we know about the symptoms that the patients are suffering from, but also the current research that's going on in psychiatry, and looking back to see how historically we've treated psychiatric illness. And, you know, as many people are aware, and I had the good fortune to listen to your previous guest a bit, you know, psychiatry has an inglorious past, and we've treated people poorly at various times when we've understood less about how the mind works. And I think to really consider the context of these illnesses and how psychiatry and the industry is, or the discipline of psychiatry has failed people in the past is an important part of understanding how we can treat these patients today.
And I'm curious as to your thoughts on the issue of stigma. As you mentioned, Melody Moisey was just with us, a young woman who was diagnosed as bipolar and asked the question, okay, when I was sick with a physical illness, everyone came to my room, brought flowers and balloons, and when I was diagnosed as a bipolar, with bipolar and could, you know, really wanted human interaction, I was locked away and everyone tried to keep the illness a secret.
I think that we're getting better with the way that mental illness is stigmatized, but we certainly are a very long distance from from being through the stigma. And I think that Melody and others like her who speak out and share the experience of their illness are such a critical part in breaking through that stigma. I think, you know, when any of us falls ill, isolation can really exacerbate our symptoms. It can make the process of illness so much harder. And I think what Melody touched upon and what I see in many of my patients is that they and their families feel very, very isolated. I think sometimes the symptoms that psychiatric patients have can be terrifying for others. And I think there's a way in which we all like to put up our hands and put some space in between us and those people with mental illness, because then it feels somehow that we could never be that we're protected from that. And the reality is, of course, none of us is protected from mental illness. It can afflict any of us. It afflicts all kinds of people. There's no one is necessarily spared. So I think one of the reasons that I wrote about these severe cases and falling into the fire is I think when someone reads about a mother who kills her children or someone who ingests sharp objects, there's a real tendency to see these people as monsters or as inhuman, and in fact, nothing could be further from the truth.
You write, and I found this fascinating in the book, but you write that it is often impossible to separate our patients' psychiatric symptoms from social circumstances, meaning we so mirror what we've gone through and what our experiences are that, and this goes on to your last point, that we can't possibly, most of us, many of us, hopefully, can't even fathom what these people have gone through in a social circumstance to get them to the mental circumstance they're in.
That's right. One of the things that people ask me a lot is, isn't it depressing to be in this job where you just hear about how horrible people's lives are and what great suffering they endure? And one of the things that I often say is that there's also just incredible hope and incredible resilience that I see in my patients. And there's something very inspiring about interacting with people who have endured what many of my patients have endured. I mean, many, many of my patients have struggled with traumatization, often repeat traumatization. Some of them have dealt with long periods of homelessness. Many of them have struggled with substance abuse and any number of indignities that life can hand out. And so I think what I often see is that people, in spite of these circumstances, are able to really draw upon strength and their own resources in order to put together a life that has some health to it.
You talked about the perception that people have of your job, of what it is like to be around patients like this. And in reading the book, it does come off very inspiring to think of the kind of endurance that some of these individuals exhibit.
I really couldn't agree more. I think that for those of us who are fortunate enough not to struggle with a chronic and persistent mental illness, it's very difficult to imagine how much of a strain this places on an individual and a family. So I'm struck by that constantly.
Crime changes it all, doesn't it? I mean, if it's if it's considered to be a crime against another human being, and then that is when that person becomes all the more a monster.
This was one of the reasons I was so interested in writing about mothers who have thoughts of killing their children. I think very few things strike us as a general public with more kind of repugnance that make us more appalled than mothers who kill their own kids. And I write about a patient in Falling Into the Fire who was having thoughts, repetitive thoughts about stabbing her young son, her 15-month-old son. And what this really became for me was a diagnostic query. Was this a patient who was having command hallucinations where she might truly be at risk of harming her child, in which case she should be kept apart from her son? Or was this someone who was having obsessive thoughts and, in fact, she would never act on these thoughts, but she was so afraid of them that what she needed in terms of treatment was to spend more time with her son to be reassured that she would not harm him? But in the chapter, that's an example of when I was really able to look at the research of what do we know about women who kill their children? What leads someone to create an act that is so unthinkable for so many of us? And what I found was story after story after story that really invoked deep compassion for these women. And I know that's sort of hard to imagine, but I think women who find themselves in that position are so often either suffering from terrible mental illness, as was the case of Andrea Yates, who really had a delusional belief that she was saving her children from damnation. Or these are people who just have absolutely no resources, have been stretched completely to the bone in terms of their own capacity to take care of people in the world, and they see no option and no outlet. They're often deeply depressed themselves. So I think having a chance to look at something that we look at and think of as monstrous or unthinkable, and really having a context to understand what might bring a person to that desperate point, is in the end what allows us to intervene and hopefully prevent some of those crimes and tragedies.
Crime and tragedy aside, what do you think it is about us that is accepting of a person's condition if it is, say, Alzheimer's disease? And you go to visit a patient who is a dear loved one to you, and they say the most outrageous and cruel thing, and it is chalked up to be, well, that is the nature of the disease. And yet, we are not as forgiving when it comes to mental illness.
What a great question. I think there is and there has been and continues to be a divide in how we view neurologic illness and psychiatric illness. And I think, as I alluded to earlier in the program, there is a component of psychiatric illness that sometimes causes people to interpret symptoms as volitional, whereas when you see a patient with Alzheimer's and they, you know, they are in the throes of forgetting and not being able to recall some basic facts, what really strikes you is that this is a brain process going on, that that's really in the forefront. And that's no less true in psychiatric illness, but I think it's easier for people to lose sight of, and so they're more apt to fail to understand psychiatric illness or even judge it in a way that neurologic illness, I think they're not likely to.
The name of the book is Falling Into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. It really is a very humane and incredibly thoughtful book. And again, it's Falling Into the Fire. It's published by the Penguin Press. Christine Montrose, thank you so much for joining us and sharing with us this morning. I really appreciate your work.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.